Good morning, New York. It's almost 8 p.m. 8 a.m., sorry. It's time to go back to bed. You're tuned to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York City. Online at WBAI.org. It's 8 a.m. in the morning, and it's time for Any Saturday with David Rothenberg. Stay tuned.
You've got to start off each day with a song. Now even when things go wrong, you feel better, you even look better. I'm here to tell you that you'll be a go-getter. Now the way that you shake my hand will tell me how I stand. Now isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong. If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day with a song.
Oh, sing it, Jimmy boy.
Even when things go wrong,
sing it for the hoi polloi.
You feel better, you even look better. Ah, that music, it does something to me. I wish I knew what it was. Last night I was telling Umbriago about my latest concerto called Tony's Pushcart. He said, Tony's Pushcart, how does it go? I said, it doesn't go, you have to push it. I got a million of them. Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song, you've got to start off each day. Boys, please, soft, little more fortissimo. I want to relate a yarn. Turn back the pages of history and what do you see? Madison Square Garden or Odeo. And there I was, interviewing a prize-winning cow. I asked her to tell the radio public how she feels. She said, moo. She's contented. I'm contented, but her husband ain't. So what happens? The bull ups to me. I ups to him. And without any preliminaries, I'm flat on my back. Being a gentleman, I apologized. But the bull's not satisfied. He demands an autopsy. So I grabs him by the tail, and what happens? He flips his tail. I lands on his head. He flips his head. I lands on his tail. He's playing ping pong with me, and I'm losing. Just then, the bull is ready to charge again. I gets an idea. I start singing, south to the border, down Mexico way. And what happens? The bull starts crying. But irregardless, I keeps on singing. This time with the castanets. That's too much for the bull. He collapses. A cheer goes up. I'm saved. And the moral is, you gotta start off each day with a song. You've gotta start off each day with a song.
Oh boy, you're singing now.
Even when things go wrong.
Oh Jimmy, you're a wow.
You feel better. You know, I'm walking down Broadway and who taps me on the shoulder? My pal, hit him in the head, Schwartz. I said, who are you working for now? And he said, the same bunch, the wife and their kids. Now, isn't it better to go through life with a smile and a song than walking around with a face 11 miles long? Now you know that you can't go wrong.
Yeah.
If you start off each day with a song.
Jimmy Durante on Saturday morning, the 28th, Mr. Jacobs, is indeed AM. We may have wished the day away, but it's not PM yet. We're still in the morning. An alert to all listeners of this program. There's a scam going out on email signed by me, albeit with my name misspelled, asking for money. It's a scam. I did not send it out. I have not asked anyone for money. I have not said that my credit card is not being accepted and therefore I'm in a tight bond. I've gotten about 24 emails and phone calls from people checking to make sure that it was really from me. It's not. And whoever has they or he or she who has broken into my computer could get the names of anyone who has ever emailed me or who I emailed, which includes so many people from WBAI listeners who have gotten theater tickets. So if you have gotten an email signed by me, misspelled my last name, it's a scam. Ignore it. Don't send money to anybody. Rip it up. Tear it up. Sounds like the start of a college cheer. I will make this announcement hourly or half hourly to alert listeners. Do not pay heed to an email from me. I have talked to a half a dozen people in the last 10 days who have COVID. A friend of mine in Vermont who was coming back to New York, his son visited, and the entire family got COVID. One of our best contacts for theater tickets, in bed with a fever. And I say that to you because this story appears in today's New York Times. Few Americans have opted to be immunized against the coronavirus so far this fall. Just over 7% of adults and 2% of children have received a COVID-19 vaccine as of October 14th. Well, there's no better way, in my eyes, and I'm not a unanimous voice on this station. Some of you pay heed to voices that tell you not to get the vaccination, and it's your personal choice. But by doing so, you're contributing to the danger of people you care about, because the vaccination is a prevention of an epidemic. According to a survey presented on Thursday to scientific advisors, the uptake is weak, even among those most at risk of severe illness. Only 1 in 5 people aged 75 or older has been vaccinated, along with about 15% of those 65 to 74, a survey of 15,000 people. More than 1,200 people are dying of COVID each week right now, according to CDC. I went into Duane Reade. I said, can I get a shot? Yes. Come in tomorrow at 9. Go to any drugstore. Get it. The epidemic is not over, and the way it'll come back is from negligence. And I've talked to people who are very conscious about their health, and they say, oh yeah, I really better get it. Yes, 1,200 people a week dying from COVID. That's not the end of an epidemic. Get the vaccination. And while you're at it, well, not at the same time, I got it over a 4-week period. First the flu, then the COVID, then the RSV. Serious stuff. I get the flu shot every year because about 25 years ago, I got into a car. I had dinner with some friends, got into a car, and I was feeling fine. Within 10 blocks, suddenly it was as if the thing had crept up my body from starting from the feet. And by the time I got to my house, the two other guests in the car had to carry me upstairs. That's how quickly it came. First, I thought I was going to die. And then I was afraid that I wouldn't die. That's how miserable I was. So I did not find getting a flu shot a compromise to my manhood. I find staying healthy is the best thing that can define me. So I urge you, especially radio listeners who tend to be an older audience, don't mess with your life. Go get the vaccination. You're living near a drugstore, get it. What else, David? I mean, there's so much to get us upset between Mike Jack Johnson and well, we'll talk about him and about Maine and the Gaza. But there's something, there's not much you can do about all that other stuff, but you can do something about your own body, and that's to protect it. You can rail on and on about being pro-Palestinian or pro-Israel or anti-war. You can scream about guns in Maine, and you can holler about Mike Johnson, and there's not much you can do about it today, but you can do something about yourself. Know what you can do and what you can't. Hello, how are you? I got it all out of my system. No, I didn't. It's still in there. We get you to the theater because we're listener-sponsored and we don't stay on the air. How can I alert you about COVID? That's why you have to go to the theater, so I can be here and shout at you. We have tickets for two things this week that I want to call to your attention. Preview start on Monday to Ode to the Wasp Woman. A lot of tickets have gone. I announced it a couple of weeks ago, and many of you responded. Sean Young, she of recent film fame, She was, I keep repeating myself, opposite. I remember she was very attractive. It was about 20 years ago, and a wonderful actress. She had an edge about her. She was Harrison Ford's leading lady in Blade Runner and Kevin Costner's in No Way Out and with Michael Jackson in Wall Street. She had a career in the movies. Well, now she's playing a has-been B-film actress. Ode to the Wasp Woman is about an homage to film noir and four people who were once, well, I wouldn't say prominent in the movies, but I remember them. Sean Young is playing Susan Cabot. She was the Wasp Woman. Did you ever see that picture? one of the other characters in it is George Reeves, the man who played Superman on television with his pot belly, concealing the body of steel. Then Alfalfa from Our Gang is in it. And then Barbara Payton is the fourth character. She of long kisses, blonde hair, and exposed breasts. They're the four characters. It's there were people that made a living in the movies, and we joked about them. And as I've said before, people, you know, somebody went to acting school or, you know, Stella Dallas or Stella Dallas, Stella Adler or Actors Studio. They didn't know where they were going. You get cast and suddenly be perfect for some terrible stereotype character. And that's who you become. You know, people, everyone starts out, they want to be Laurence Olivier or Betty Davis. And some of them end up being Susan Cabot and Barbara Payton and Alfalfa and poor old George Reeves with his potbelly Superman. Anyway, the play is Ode to the Wasp Woman. It's about people from those people who made a career. They probably made a good living with those characters that they played. A lot of the tickets went. The Wednesday matinee are gone, and so are the Saturday matinee. But we still have tickets for Monday night at 7:30, Thursday night at 7:30, and next Sunday matinee at 3:00. It's at the Actors Temple on West 47th Street. And then we have some tickets for the whole following week, including matinees on Wednesday and Sunday. If you want to see Ode to the Wasp Woman and support this cockamamie station, you email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. You give your phone number and you will get a phone call from me today. Now, and wouldn't that be exciting, chatting with me? And I got to get the calls in before who's Notre Dame playing? Somebody interesting. I don't think that goes on until 3:30. There's some good football on today. And the Knicks are on tonight. They won last night. They beat, who did they beat? I watched the game. They beat Atlanta. And World Series is on. And Texas won last inning. They tied up Arizona and they won in the 10th. And I slept through it all. We also have tickets, by the way, for the Ode to the Wasp Woman, it's $50 for a pair. And for those of you who have become accustomed to going to the Joyce Theater as I celebrate this wonderful, gosh, we're lucky to have the Joyce Theater that brings dance from all over the world and such stunning companies that perform from Japan. The Sankai Juko, and it's an homage to the history of Japanese dance. Exotic, different, special. And we have tickets for a Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday night at the Joyce Theater on 19th Street and 8th Avenue. A $60 gift to BAI and gets you in. And what you do is email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com and give you a phone number. So, you know, the price is right. Somebody, I had a long conversation yesterday, day before yesterday. Why don't you charge more? Why don't you charge more? People are getting in and it's, you know, triple of, you could get more. And I said, well, there are a lot of people that can't afford going to the theater these days because they've been priced out. And one of the things that we have done is we're celebrating shows by giving it airtime that they might not otherwise not have. But at the same time, we're getting people to see why we're in New York, the cultural diversity, the richness. I mean, he had a Japanese dance company, a play at an homage to the corny actors from 50 years ago. That's why we're here. Otherwise, we could be in Pittsburgh. Now, I don't want the listeners in Pittsburgh, and they're there, to yell at me. But there's reasons why we are in New York, and part of it is the cultural diversity. So I hope you take advantage of it. We play music also, don't we, Mr. Jacob? So I'll stop babbling for a second. I hope you're planning on getting a vaccination today, and you can do that. Here's Michael Bublé with a song by Leslie Bricos and Tony Newley. It must be from Stop the World, I Want to Get Off. Maybe, maybe not. Michael Bublé.
Birds flying high, you know how I feel. Sun in the sky, you know how I feel. Breeze drifting on by, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me. And I'm feeling good. I'm feeling good. Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on a tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me. And I'm feeling good. Dragonfly out in the sun, you know what I mean, don't you know? Butterflies all having fun, you know what I mean. Sleep in peace when day is done, that's what I mean. And this old world is a new world, and a bold world for me. Sands of the pine, you know how I feel. Oh, freedom is mine, and I know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life. It's a new dawn, it's a new day.
Michael Bublé, and I'm David Rothenberg, and he's still Michael Bublé. Robert Card was, according to the news reports, was found dead, put a bullet in his head. The man that they were searching for, responsible for the carnage in Lewiston, Maine. I am so angry about the coverage, the piety from the political response, and the reality that nothing is going to change. It didn't change after a gunman slaughtered children in a schoolroom in Connecticut. It didn't change after an Orlando club was saturated with blood and bodies. It didn't change when tourists in Las Vegas were shot down in a hotel. Mike Johnson, the new speaker, has talked about the Bible and the Second Amendment. I don't know which one he finds more sanctimonious, using the Bible as a smokescreen to defend the Second Amendment. When they were talking about, here's what happened. I want to put on The View on, I think it was Wednesday or Thursday, and the program was interrupted. Breaking news. It had been on the news all morning, and it was on the news after The View, but they cut in for 20 minutes to have a press conference with inaudible speakers. The police chief in Lewiston made sense. The political people and the questions were predictable and irrelevant. And then the newscasters kept telling us that in New York City, we have to be on the alert. And I said, the chances are he's holed up somewhere if he hasn't put a bullet in his head. And that's exactly what happened. I'm not bragging because I'm right. It's just they were using it to scare us instead of talking about. I'm scared of the stupidity of elected officials who cannot respond to this by changing. I've reached the point. I'm not for legislation to lift the age or expect it to remove. Stop all manufacturing of guns and eliminate all guns. And I don't care if hunters, if you think hunting is important to you, you want to go kill a deer, learn how to bowl. That's my answer. I don't care if you want to go out and hunt deer, kill deer and rabbits or whatever it is you want to kill. Get rid of all the guns. Just get rid of them. Stop manufacturing. Close Colt industry. I'm not interested in band-aids on gangrene. I talked to guys at Fortune. They said all this legislative talk about limiting the amount of weapons. One of the guys said, you want some weapons, David? I can get it for you. You get them illegally. It's not just at the gun fairs, but get rid of the gun fairs for starters. And I don't think the Second Amendment is sanctimonious. Sacrosanct. I don't think it is sanctimonious. I don't think it's sacrosanct. I think the Second Amendment can go. It was created to protect people from the English back in 1776. They're not around anymore. The threat is not the English. It's other Americans who have weapons. Stop manufacturing them. Get them all off the street. Have I expressed myself? And I'm tired of hearing political people. And they were up in Maine. The congressman there suddenly said, oh, no, I'm no longer pro-gun. And then they told us to pray for the families. It's a little late to pray for the families whose relatives have been slaughtered in a senseless carnage. Get rid of the guns. And the media was horrendous. They were selling fear. They couldn't talk about it enough. And they love going you lost your husband and your son. How do you feel? Get that microphone out of that woman's face. Leave her alone. How do I segue into theater tickets? You think I'm angry today? I haven't even started on Mike Johnson yet. Or the Middle East. And I'm boiling. Oh, we do have tickets for a couple of shows. And you know that, why did I watch basketball, baseball, and football last night? Because the news is, I just said one thing. I was watching MSNBC and they were covering the Middle East over and over and over again, the same thing. And they had half the screen was black. And it was, and every now and then you saw a little light go, and they were covering the Gaza. They were covering the war where nothing was happening. But they held us there for a black screen. None of them are advocating for peace. That they're all everybody's so busy taking sides and accusing. Just stop the shooting and then sit down and talk. Then you can start accusing everybody and saying who's the cause and who did what. What Hamas did was horrendous. What Netanyahu was doing before was horrible. Stop them. Sit down and talk. Stop killing people who had nothing, don't even know what the parameters of the battle were. Pick a subject. I'll rage about it. We have theater tickets coming off Broadway. Make Me Gorgeous. I want to see this one. I heard about Kenneth Marlowe. This is the story of Kenneth Marlowe. He was known as Mr. Madam. Who's playing? The actor playing him is, we'll find that out. Kenneth Marlowe was a hairdresser. I remember seeing a program about him on television. He was a gay man. He was a hairdresser to the stars in Hollywood. And then he became a notorious of a gay prostitute ring. And some of the biggest stars in Hollywood were his customers. That was the juicy part. I was surprised at some of the people that were fingered, if you will, in it. And this is a show about this man. It's called Make Me Gorgeous, the fabulous, incredible true story of Kenneth Marlowe, adapted from the book Mr. Madam, The Life and Times of Kenneth Marlowe. And who's playing him? Well, his name is Donnie. That's all you get. And, oh, it's starring Wade McCollum. Wade McCollum, who starred on Broadway in Wicked, is playing Kenneth Marlowe. So that's coming to the Playhouse at St. Luke's on West 46th Street, starting the weekend of Friday, November 10th. And we have tickets that weekend, Friday and Saturday night and Sunday matinee and evening, and then the whole following week. Make Me Gorgeous, story of a male madam, hairdresser to the stars, the madam of a notorious gay prostitute ring in Hollywood, a hustler. He became a female impersonator. Oh, and in his last 10 years, he became Kate Marlowe. He had a sex change. If you call me, I'll tell you, well, maybe it's in the show about some of the men that, some of the stars that hired him for male prostitution. It was with male prostitutes. Interesting. Email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. On the other end of the dramatic spectrum, War Words is coming to the Art Theater. War Words is the work of Michelle Close Brooks. She had written a play several years ago, and she was on this program called Hitless Tasters, based on the women that were hired to taste Hitler's food before he ate them. And she's now written a play called War Words. Boy, is this timely. A docu-play, and the characters in the play, the actors, are playing men and women who she interviewed, and it's their stories based on veterans and family members of people who were touched directly by the war in Afghanistan and throughout the Middle East. The words of men and women who served in the military during the Afghanistan and Iraqi wars, based on the interviews with the veterans. Very important at this point. That we start having tickets for that if you want to plan ahead. The week of Thanksgiving week, Tuesday the 21st, Wednesday the 22nd, Friday the 24th, and then over the weekend, Saturday and Sunday matinees. And that's also $50 for two tickets. Email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com. And for the first time in a long time, I'm not going to play Mr. Jacobs will press a button and we'll hear. Remember Tracy Chapman? She had a run years ago and she was big. I always think of the late Dred Scott, Jesse Keys from BAI. He was such a fan of hers. And the first one that told me about Tracy Chapman. Here she is with I think this is the song that made called a lot of attention to her, called Talking About a Revolution. Tracy Chapman.
Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. While they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of those armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds like a whisper. Who are people gonna rise up and get their share? Who are people gonna rise up and take what's there? Don't you know you better run, 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 run. Oh, I said you better run, 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 run. Cause finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about the revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh, while they're standing in the welfare lines, crying at the doorsteps of the armies of salvation, wasting time in the unemployment lines, sitting around waiting for a promotion. Don't you know, talking about a revolution sounds a whisper. And finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution. Yes, finally the tables are starting to turn. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution, oh no. Talking about a revolution.
Tracy Chapman. You know, at the beginning of the program, I said that I alerted listeners that a scam email has gone out signed by me, misspelling my name, asking for money. If you have received it, it is a scam. I have not sent out emails asking for money. Now, having said that, I wonder if my usually in the first half hour when I have announced tickets for shows, my email, at least a couple of people email me. I haven't gotten a single email at dprfortune@hotmail.com. I wonder if they have the scammers have blocked that up. So for this morning, until we correct that, I've gotten no emails today either on usually I get a half a dozen emails in the first 6 minutes telling me to shut up or we agree with you or we want tickets for something. I have gotten none. So email me if you wanted any of the things that I talked about, theater tickets. Email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org and give your phone number or let me know that you're listening. I'd be curious if anybody has tried to email me at dprfortune@hotmail.com because I've received no emails and I'm having this scam going out in my name and they may have frozen my email. Oh, God, modern technology and David, we don't work well together at all. So somebody email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org and let me know if they've tried to email me at the other email. It's nice to talk to you this way. Remember when we used to talk to each other on phones and in person? Now it's all on computer. Nobody talks to each other. I've gone to people's office and their phones are blinking away, and I say, answer your phone. They say, oh, we don't talk to people on the phone. We email them. All right, I'm going to do, nothing's coming in anywhere. So maybe everything's blocked. No theater tickets, no nothing. Here is Out on a Limb. Is anyone listening? I don't even know if am I on the air? When the Fortune Society began in 1967, there were 13,000 men incarcerated in New York State prisons. At the height of the drug arrest explosion as a result of the Rockefeller drug law, 30 years later, there were close to 90,000 people in lockup at the Empire State. Rockefeller's well-publicized anti-drug, anti-crime posturing swept the nation, and similar inflated figures were evident in almost every corner of the nation. As it evolved, a fiscal and political power merged. It was called the prison industrial complex. Two components of the drug laws became apparent, inspired by Nelson Rockefeller's hunger to be president of the United States. Perceived as an Eastern liberal, suspect by hardcore traditional Republicans, the New York Skyan set out to reinvent himself, to emerge palatable to the old guard, the influential Bob Taft wing of the party, a faction supported and sustained by corporate magnates who sought and won protection on issues important to them. High taxes imposed on the rich by FDR during the Depression were slowly winding down, and federal regulations on industry which interfered with corporate profits. That was the centerpiece that hit a high point with Reaganomics. Being perceived as tough on crime was a boilerplate issue for the GOP. It veiled racism, a vital ingredient. It told the white vox populi that they were concerned about their safety, and they had the muscle to impose rigorous laws, longer sentences, more bad guys, mostly black and brown, get them off the streets. The trade-off hidden from the masses was you'll be voting against your own best economic interest, but we will shield you from them. The big money guys also funded issues that evoked emotional responses. Anti-abortion and later anti-immigration politics detracted from close examination of government fiscal priorities, protecting the privileged. Influencers like Lee Atwater and Karl Rove mastered plans of fear after formulating Nixon's Southern strategy, mobilizing white voters and disenfranchising black voters. They reached their apex when Daddy Bush vied to succeed Ronald Reagan, and an insidious television commercial became the overt posture of the Republican Party. A black man going round and around in a revolving door, identified as Willie Horton, an accused rapist murderer whose crimes were attributed to Democratic candidate Massachusetts Governor Michael Dukakis, whose furlough program for prisoners was sold as the political cause of crime, and which said that Democrats are soft on crime, and the result being that corporate priorities would be protected. The Willie Hortons of the world were to be kept in cages, and if you voted right, and I mean right, black men equaled crime, white men talking tough equaled safety. I became aware of the big profits in the building and maintaining of prisons, a key part to this plot. I attended the annual American Correctional Association conference held in a Midwestern city, attended by wardens, many elected officials, and an array of second-tier corporate officials. The seminars and the speakers were predictable. The thrust was to have more construction and to create legislation that defined more crimes so more people could be locked up. That was part of their discussion and their plan, starting with drugs, widening the net. The eye-opener for me was the adjoining humongous field house in which a multitude of vendors were contracting with prison representatives from 50 states and from numerous counties and cities and buyers of the federal system. The wide range of products was astounding, from barbed wire to inflammable blankets sold by the thousands, food, cigarettes, toilet bulbs, architectural designs for new facilities, and cement and steel to build them. The prison industrial complex at work. Big, big money at stake here. The anti-crime political stance was married to profits, reducing crime of less interest. There were a multitude of reasons to lock up more people and for the recidivist rate to remain high. Target those who have the least powerful voices in the community, the disenfranchised. A second and even more devious condition was a result of mass incarceration. And here's how this plays. Arrest, convict, sentence, and encage black and brown men and women and punish them for life. Few people will advocate for men and women identified by the crime they committed, no matter how long ago it was. Make sure that they don't vote. Legislate it if necessary. And so they did. No vote. This is mid-80s I'm talking. No vote for life. Taking political power away from the communities that have the most men and women incarcerated and have the greatest need for government support and a safety net to deal with their schools and their parks and their neighborhoods. But where there is the least support. In New York State, more recently, Governor Andrew Cuomo, with a whisk of the pen, gave parolees the right to vote in New York, which is a deeply blue state. So the national balance of power was unaffected, but it did give thousands a sense of dignity and a stake in their government. The Florida story is quite different and continues to have a vast impact on representation for all people. Florida for years was a seesaw state, electing Democrats and Republicans. The 2000 presidential race, Gore and Bush famously disclosed the party closeness, separated by a faulty voting booth. Then the strategists went to work. Several years ago, a statewide referendum in Florida overwhelmingly concluded that formerly incarcerated persons had the right to vote. Several hundred thousand Floridians in one swoop gained the right to vote. A population, a great majority of whom were African American and Latino, reflecting the state's high rate of arrests and convictions that are racially inspired. The referendum suggested that Democrats would benefit by a wide margin. So up at the state capitol in Tallahassee, the Republican governor and the GOP-controlled state assembly passed legislation that felons, before voting, would have to pay fines, some of various amounts, part of their atonement for the crimes, ignoring the fact that that's why they were sent to prison. That was the punishment. But no, in Florida, in fact, created a poll tax for thousands of the state's poorest citizens, recently released prisoners. They even made it a misdemeanor for outsiders to be involved in voting drives and raising funds to vote. The result was George DeSantis, two Republican state senators, or senators in Washington. Other states with Republican governors and state legislation have paid attention to Florida's flight from full voter participation. In Virginia, 60,000 former prisoners remain disenfranchised. Kentucky and Iowa are looking closely also, with different perspectives, because Kentucky has a Democratic governor, Andy Besh, and in 2019, he signed an order giving 190,000 one-time felons the right to vote, which is now being challenged in the courts by the Republicans. Who knows how that will turn out? The sum of the story, this is what it came down to. Arrest blacks and poor whites, punish them, and make it stick for life. Scare the population with crime stories, you watch cable television every night? It's saturated with crime stories, sponsored well by corporations, some of which I saw selling their wares in that field house at a correction conference. These are well-thought-out public relations campaign, which has little or nothing to do with safety on the streets and a great deal to do with ignoring safety and health threats through regulations. Profits over people and prison and the prison industrial complex is complicit in making us a nation that loves the concept of democracy more than the reality. Stop them from voting. That's the mission. The walls in those bastilles are high to keep the secrets concealed and designing a system that perpetuates itself. Let's start with Rikers Island if you want to know the high cost of maintaining an institution that nurtures alienation. It costs $500,000 a year per person to be maintained on Rikers Island. That's not a made-up figure, $500,000 a year per person. It's expensive to keep them in there, and fight they are right now to keep them in there. One of the major causes of crime in America is the prison system. It's where people become alienated and learn more about crime. But big money shields the truth. Nelson Rockefeller never became president. He sent in the troops to kill prisoners and guards at Attica. He introduced a drug law that eventually cost billions of dollars and in its infancy helped to create the prison industrial complex while destroying American lives. And it was all because of political, misguided political ambition. Nelson Rockefeller died during coitus interruptus with a woman not named Happy. You won't read about that in the history books in Florida. I'm David Rothenberg, out on a limb. And here's Bobby Short.
Never let your feelings show. Make it breezy, breezy, breezy. Easy come and easy go. Never smile too brightly, brightly when your heart is riding high. Let your heart break, oh, so slightly when your baby says goodbye. That well-known flame is mighty hot, as all of us have learned. So handle it with velvet gloves, and you won't get your fingers burned. Take love easy, 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 on the free and easy plan. And if you can't, take it easy, take it easy as you can. Thank you. us have learned. So handle it with velvet gloves, and you won't get your fingers burned. And if you can't take it easy, as you can, take it easy, easy, that's the plan.
Bobby Short with a Duke Ellington song. And you know who wrote that with him? John Latouche. Interesting combo. John Latouche was the lyricist for the Golden Apple. And I worked on a revival of the Golden Apple and met John Latouche. And he was Duke's partner. Can you imagine? Well, obviously, my old email address is not functioning. I received over 24 emails at the drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. I have to eliminate the other one, get a new password, because I have been hacked into. And many of you have sent me emails just in the last 5 or 10 minutes saying, yes, you got an email from me with my name misspelled asking for money, and it's a scam. Ignore it. Don't pay attention to it. It's a fake. And when we catch them, I'm going to make give them literature about the Fortune Society so when they come out of prison that we can work and on giving them a life that they can make an honest living. All right, since I was kept giving you information about shows for which we have tickets and giving you an email address that no longer works, I'm now going to reiterate what we talked about, what shows we have tickets for, and then you can decide. And then I'll give you the working email address. Ode to the Wasp Woman, which is a new play, starts previews this week, starring Sean Young of movie star fame. It chronicles the last 48 hours in the lives of four 1950s B-movie stars, Susan Cabot, George Reeves, Superman, Carl Switzer, who was Alfalfa, and Barbara Payton. It's at the Actors Temple, and we have tickets for Monday night, Thursday night, and Sunday matinee this week, and then all of next week, including Wednesday and Sunday matinees. $50 to be AI. For two tickets, email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. This is a one-day only use of it, and I will get to you today. Then we have tickets this week at the Joyce Theater for the internationally acclaimed Japanese dance company, the Sankai Juko, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday night. And of course, as I've been yapping forever, that we are so fortunate to be in the era in which the Joyce Theater exists to bring the finest dance companies in the world in this beautiful theater of 500 seats. No matter wherever you're sitting, you have a wonderful seat at the Joyce. So that's $60 for a pair of tickets to see the Sankai Jukes. Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday night, email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. Give your phone number and I'll call you back. Make Me Gorgeous, a new play coming in about, the colorful, fabulous Kenneth Marlowe, who was, they describe him as a trailblazer in gay rights. I don't know if he was a trailblazer in gay rights. He was a colorful personality who became a madam for male hustlers and service big movie stars. That's what I remember him when I read about him. It's called Make Me Gorgeous. It's coming to St. Luke's starting Friday, November, that first weekend. Well, that's actually the second week of November, Friday the 10th, Friday night, Friday and Saturday night, and Saturday and Sunday matinee. Make Me Gorgeous, Playhouse at St. Luke's, $50 for a pair of tickets. And then we also announced tickets for War World, Michelle Brooks's play, a docudrama based on the live, based from interviews of soldiers and family members who were affected directly by the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, and certainly timely for us to You know, we, as each new war comes about, we become jingoistic and forget the pain. And maybe it's more poignant than ever for war words to be seen. It's coming to the Art Theater, and we have tickets Thanksgiving week, starting that Tuesday and every day by Thanksgiving night, including matinee Saturday and Sunday. And that's $50 for two tickets for War Words. And you email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. I want to talk about, him. Well, I don't know about him. When I say him, Kenneth Johnson, maybe I'll wait on that. Let's hear from Mary Martin. And while Mary is singing, perhaps, Mr. Jacobs, we can call our guest, Stanley Richards, and we'll have a conversation with the newly appointed CEO of the Fortune Society. In the meantime, from the London production of Hello, Dolly, in which Mary Martin starred, here she is with Jerry Herman's So Long, Dearie.
It looks like there's only one more thing I can say. Goodbye, 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 goodbye. Don't try to stop me, Horace, please. Wave your little hand and whisper so long, dearie. You ain't gonna see me anymore. But when you discover that your life is dreary, don't you come a-knocking at my door. 'Cause I'll be all dolled up and singing that song that says, you dog, I told you so. So wave your little hand and whisper so long, dearie. Dearie should have said so long, so long ago. Because you treated me so rotten and rough, I've had enough of feeling low. So wave your little hand and whisper so long, dearie. Dearie should have said so long, so long ago. For I can hear that choo-choo calling me on to a fancy new address. Yes, I can hear that choo-choo calling me on aboard the Happiness Express. I'm gonna learn to hoochie-cooch and smoke a cigarette. I'm gone as far away from Yonkers as a girl can get. And on those cold winter nights, Horace, you can snuggle up to your cash register. It's a little lumpy, but it rings. Don't come a-knocking, I'll be all dolled up and singing that song that says, you dog, I told you so. Horace, you will find your life a sad old story when you see a dolly shuffle off to glory. Oh, I should have said so.
That's Mary Martin. I'm David Rothenberg. Is Stanley Richards with us? Hello, hello. Mr. Jacobs, have we reached Stanley Richards?
Yes, I am on. Can you hear me?
Oh, I can. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
And you are Stanley Richards. I recognize the dulcet tones in your voice. I can say it publicly, my dear, dear friend, who has taught me how to say I love you.
Yes.
It's the toughest thing for men to do, is to say to somebody maybe later on we can discuss that, Stanley. Well, I think I've talked about it on the air. You've told me if it's difficult to say that, just rub my nose.
Yes,
Stanley, before you start in January as the CEO of Fortune, I want to talk to you about your whole life, not the politics of and the work, but who you are. And before we start on that, I just want to say that I've had many, many times with you that I treasure, though for several years, driving me home from the Thursday night meetings at the Castle, where we really talked about the men and the women that we are hearing and what they need and the passion and the caring. But two things. One, when I went with you and Tara, your wife, and your son, Sherry Goldstein was with us also, your wonderful grandson, DJ, we went to Washington to the White House during the Obama years, where you were honored. That was exciting. But
it was exciting and special.
All of that. But you know what moment defines you and who you are the most to me? When you were on the Board of Corrections, you said, I'm going to Rikers today, come with me. And we went into a room with about 20 men, and you were wearing your suit and your tie, and you looked like a banker, or and you gave one of those pep talks, and they were listening with that, yeah, we've heard it all, look. And then you said, quite simply, I sat in this room 20 years ago before they sent me up north. And I've never seen the electricity in a room change more dramatically. And these guys suddenly from their slumber, what do you mean? And they surrounded you and they couldn't believe that you had been in their seat. And I saw the power of someone formerly incarcerated coming in looking as prosperous and speaking as beautifully and as powerfully as you did. The impact on who you had been and who you are now, giving hope and direction. It was astounding. And I felt privileged to be witness to that. And, you know, we've seen it in various shapes and forms when people come to fortune, but nothing like that. And so, one, thank you for letting me be with you then. And secondly, who are you, Stanley Richards? Where did you grow up? What kind of education did you have? And how and where did you get in trouble that led you to be incarcerated?
You know, when I think about that moment when we went out to Rikers and I was talking to the men, I remember being them. I remember not having hope, not ever envisioning life could be different for me. It was like I learned how to live in that environment. And so I did. I learned how to survive on Rikers. I learned how to survive up north, and I learned how to survive on the streets. And that's all I thought my life would be. And it wasn't until I went up north and I went to school. I'm a GED, went to college.
But before that, Stanley,
I could do differently.
Where did you go to as a child, though? Where did you grow up, and where did you get in trouble? Were you a gang kid or what?
Yeah. So I grew up in Soundview Projects in the Bronx. You know, my mother and father were married. They both worked. I had a younger brother, a younger sister, older sister, and four other sisters who my father had from another marriage. So it was normal. It was like you grow up in the projects, and at that time it was in the 60s. You know, everybody in our building and our floor, we were like family. We were, you know, growing up, we used to do fun things. And then in 1971, when I was 10, my brother was, I think, 6. My baby sister was 2. And my older sister was 13 or 14. It was on December 10th. Right before Christmas, my parents normally got up, got dressed, going to work, said goodbye, would see us later. And later that night, my father didn't get home until about 8 or 9 o'clock. And he walked through the door with his cousin, and he had my mother's coat, and he had her pocketbook. And he pulled us in a circle and said, "Your mother's not coming home. Your mother just died." Hmm. My mother was 34 years old. And that changed my life. I was devastated. I was devastated. And in you know, 1971, it's unheard of a single, you know, widowed African-American man raising four kids, two girls and two boys. But my father did it. He made a commitment to us, and our, you know, our friends and family sort of helped him. But I got lost in the sauce. You know, I tried to kill myself. I could not understand how my mother could leave me and leave us and why. And I was just devastated. And I ended up, my father worked really hard to keep us together, keep food in the refrigerator. And I just went to the streets and I joined, back then it was the Black Spades. I joined the Baby Spades. I was in the, then you graduate to the Young Spades, then you go to the Black Spades. And I got caught up in the gangs and stopped going to school. I didn't even go to my eighth grade graduation, although I didn't really earn the graduation because I never was in class. Back then, they would do social promotion based on your age. And so I just took to the streets and I started getting high and I started selling drugs. I started getting arrested. And that was the life I started living. And that's what I seen in Soundview on Cozy Corner, that you go out there, you hustle. The risk of hustling is getting arrested. And it's this vicious cycle that you just get, you lose who you are and you lose what becomes any potential because you don't see the world. You don't see New York City. All I saw was Soundview. I knew I wasn't traveling into Manhattan. And back then, you know, travel from one neighborhood to the next. So it was like this little corner of the Bronx that was my world. And my world was drugs, arrest, and jail.
When did, at what age did you get locked up and where and what happened when you were locked up?
My first arrest was when I was a teenager. And when the courthouse wasn't on 100 and it was on 3rd Avenue, Central Booking used to be on 3rd Avenue in the courthouse. That's when I got arrested and ended up going to Spofford. And then just started cycling from there. Just started cycling and living that life. I tried to sort of break out of that life, but was trapped. And then addiction took hold and later on in my life, and that was the end of it.
You went in and out several times to different joints and then hit the streets and then went back? Is that what happened?
Yeah.
A revolving door. So you had started to say, and I cut you off to go back to the early days. I've heard you talk about it, but not in detail, and it's always moved me about where you were when suddenly things started to change. It was education, obviously, yeah, as you tell it.
Yeah.
Where was it, and what happened?
It was in, you know, it was in state prison, but during that time, my life was so crazy that the dysfunction and the harm of Rikers was, for me, a really good place because I was able to maneuver. So I was on Rikers during my case. I was on Rikers for over 2 years. I went in 86, and I ended up going upstate in 88. And that was normal to me. And I think back then it was like, you know, 20,000 people in the system. But I knew how to maneuver in that world. And then I went upstate, and you know, you go upstate, you got to go through programs. And so they asked me what program I wanted to, what I wanted to do. And I said, well, I'd like to go to school. And I thought I needed to start it in what they call adult basic education. And the program committee had more faith in me. I don't know. They said, well, let's try you in pre-GED. And I tried in pre-GED, studied and took the pre-GED test. And they said, wow, you're ready for the GED test. And I studied for the GED test and took the GED and passed on my first attempt. And then the teacher said, why don't you, and back then they had college, they said, why don't you think about college? I was at college. I was working in pre-release.
They still had college programs then before Pataki eliminated it, right?
It ended shortly after I got out, actually. And I said, said, okay, I went to college, and I started getting A's and B's, and I really enjoyed reading and talking about what we were studying and how it related to my life and the world. And it just
You never had that in school before, huh?
No. It just opened up another world for me. And I realized at that point that I didn't have to cycle in and out. Like, I didn't have to go on the street and survive. And when you survive, when you're in survival mode, chances of coming back were very, very high. I didn't have to do that. And I wanted to do something different. And because I was working in pre-release, I said, pre-release is sort of like helping other people prepare, other incarcerated men prepare for the board. I said, I'd love to be able to do something like this in the community, helping people understand that they have choices and they don't have to live the life that they've always lived, that they are better than that, that they are more than that. And so I came home. I met my
Stanley, can I take
wife.
A step back, one step back? And that
sure.
was what when you were taking those college classes, were there any books or people whose insight suddenly had an impact on you?
Yeah.
Can you recall?
Oh, yeah. I remember the book. And it was the book. It was Malcolm X's book.
Mm.
That gave me so much hope when I read his story. And I said,
and he had done time.
He started.
Yeah.
He had done time and he was hustling. And it was like, that's how I felt. Like, he was out there and he thought he had to do it. And then when he went to prison, you know, he met brothers from Islam that was, you know, Muslims, and instilled in him a kind of power that he doesn't have to be like a, you know, a blade of grass blowing in the wind. Like, he can stand tall in who he is, and he's better than the conk he had in his hair. He's better than the hustle he had.
Mm-hmm.
He's better than the, you know, womanizing stuff he used to do. He's better than all of that. And I said, man, that he ended up transforming not only his life, but thousands and thousands. And he transformed my life because that book gave me so much hope.
Oh.
And
so when you came out,
on this,
I'm sorry.
No, go.
No, go ahead.
No,
when you came out, what happened? Yeah. You suddenly saw different.
Yeah,
you had options that you never knew existed. Is that what it was?
Well, when I was still in, I said, when I get out, I know it's going to be hard, and as long as I don't give up on myself, right? And this is hope. Like, as long as I have hope that, you know, better days are coming, and that I have a chance, I won't give up on myself. Because I knew once I give up on myself, I'm going to go back to the street. Because giving up on myself is like losing all hope. And so
now,
I
want to ask
home,
you a question about your self-awareness at the time. You have emerged, this is my opinion of you, as a charismatic leader that has great impact when people meet you. Did you have any hint of leadership quality back then? Did you know
no.
that? Did you have any awareness of what you know, feel now?
No, it was, I had mentors and people that you see, like Eddie Ellis. When Eddie Ellis came home, I think he came home shortly after me, and he came to Fortune and he talked about his life and he talked about the work that he's doing. You know, it was like leaders that were already out there doing this kind of work and how they were showing up in the space. They were showing up like they wasn't just thankful for an invitation, but they were seeking true partnership, true leadership roles. And Fortune was the organization that sort of clicked on the first light, because all the other organizations I applied to said, oh no, you got to have experience. They didn't value the experience I had when I was on the inside, like being a director of pre-release and doing that work. But Fortune did. And when Fortune hired me, Fortune was the organization that walked the walk. And I felt like you always say, Fortune didn't see me for how much time I did. how many drugs I used, how many times I messed up. They only seen what I can contribute to Fortune's community. And I think that was huge for me. And I had mentors at Fortune, and that was the beginning. And when I met my wife, and I met her mother, I was afraid.
Where did you meet Tara?
I met Tara at a friend's house. I had just came home, and she had just come back from her father's house in, I think, Virginia. And we met. And when she walked in the door, I'll never forget it. She's still so beautiful, but she was the most beautiful woman I ever saw, and I couldn't keep my eyes off her. And I approached her, and, you know, I approached her and started talking to her. And we had dinner a couple of days later. She cooked some dinner, and that was the beginning of it, and we started dating. And when I met her mother, I was afraid her mother, because her mother was a Jehovah's Witness, I was afraid her mother would be judgmental. And these are all what I call stones of remembrance, of people showing you love when you don't think they're going to show you love, that then builds the love in your heart. And when I met her, she was like, tell me about you. And I was afraid to tell her that I was formerly incarcerated. I just came home from prison. And she had a sense of it. And she said, no, really, tell me about yourself. And when I told her, she asked something like, have you been in prison? Are you in prison? Have you been in prison? And I said, yes. And she said, I don't care what you've been experienced. I don't care that you've been in prison. The only thing I care about is that you don't hurt my daughter. Mm. And it was such love that she spoke with, and acceptance of me. That was another check mark of when someone shows you love, like that just deepens your own heart and your ability to love. And I've had those experiences, and Tara and I got married. We've been married now 33 years, have 4 beautiful children, 9 beautiful grandchildren. And she has showed me love, Tara, throughout this journey. And I'm just thankful that I'm in a place at Fortune where I can walk with that in my heart. And when I see people, I don't see them for what they did. I don't see them for their struggles. I only see what is possible for them. And our job at Fortune is to hold the image of who they could be until they begin to see it for themselves, believe it, and then begin to live it. That's what we do at the Castle on Thursday. That's what we do every day when people walk into our space. You won't see magnetometers. You won't see, we don't search bags, because we treat people the way we want to be treated. And we want to be welcomed into our community. We want to be appreciated and valued. And we want to hold each other accountable.
Stanley, your journey has been extraordinary. You're going to be the CEO. Fortune in 55 years, only 3 CEOs, means that people don't leave there quickly. You were one of the first formerly incarcerated people to become a member of the Board of Corrections, which meant you went in to oversee how conditions were on Rikers and other New York City facilities. But even more incredibly, when Vinnie Schiraldi was made commissioner near the end of de Blasio's campaign,
hello.
Please hold on for him. listening to WBAI at 99.5 FM in New York City. We seem to have lost David, and hopefully we'll get him back shortly. In the meantime, please stay tuned, and can you please hold on for a few more minutes? Mr. Richards, hopefully he should be joining us. Okay, thank you.
Yes.
Go ahead, David.
Hello. What happened, Mr. Jacobs? Is Stanley with us?
Yes, he's with us. Stanley's with us.
Stanley?
Stanley's still with us. Please go ahead.
Mr. Richards? I don't hear him. So somebody's messing with my computer. I'm on the air via the computer, and obviously the forces of evil have intervened. I don't hear Mr. Richards at all. And I don't hear you, Mr. Jacobs.
Can you hear me?
Yes, Stanley, are you there? The forces of evil have intervened. I don't know if you heard me earlier that my a scam has gone out. Hundreds of people have gotten emails from me asking for money. They've
including me. I got it.
You got one? Did you send it?
Oh. I sent it to our IT people, which said we need to clean this up and
yeah, get a new password. So what happened then? Did you? We just went off the air.
I think your system got disconnected. I was still on.
Oh, and so what did you answer my question when I'm going to ask it again. I was asking you about being a deputy commissioner of correction. What went through your, how did you deal with it externally and internally?
Oh, it's so interesting. When Vinny called me, first of all, I almost fell out of my chair. When he asked me to serve as his first deputy commissioner, And of course, you know, I came home and spoke to Tara, and Tara and I prayed and prayed. And what I got was, this is the path that my Lord and Savior had ordered for me. And so I accepted. And I went into that saying that I'm going to walk into this job like I show up at Fortune every day. I'm walking into this job making sure that people feel seen, heard, and valued. And that's what I did. And we started to build out some innovative programs for young adults. We was about to build out an innovative program for adults in a facility we closed, OBCC. We were looking at revising the training and being able to prepare officers to deal emotionally and connect with incarcerated people, engage in incarcerated people. We were looking to sort of move the case process along. So it was an opportunity for me to walk in the light that I think I've always walked in at Fortune in the Department of Correction.
And I got to tell you, how did correction officers respond to you?
You know, I think at first they were very skeptical and very concerned. Oh, this formerly incarcerated guy is going to be, you know, running the second in command in the department. What are we doing? Everything is falling apart. But I got to tell you, the kind of appreciation and acknowledgement of how I showed up every day from officers was amazing. When I got promoted to be CEO, an officer called me and said, I know you're not with the department. I'm still going to call you commissioner, but I just want to tell you congratulations on your appointment to be president and CEO of Fortune. Very proud of you. Keep up the good work. Another officer texted me and said, in his 18 years in the department, he has never worked with anybody who showed up like how I showed up. That at first was very skeptical, but then he came, got to know me and just appreciated for how I showed up. Because, you know, Joanne and I talk about this often. We say a rising tide lifts all boats. And my work when I went to the department was to try to rise the tide. So that we have safe facilities, so that we have programs and we're engaging incarcerated people so they feel valued and not judged, because we're not the judge nor the jury, and that officers feel safe and feel included. So I walked in that light.
Yeah. So, Stanley Richards, you stood on the street corner in the Bronx and sold drugs. You went to prison. You got an education and you suddenly realized that this didn't have to be your life, and you emerged as one of the most extraordinary leaders in the history of criminal justice. My perception, and I've been around longer than anybody I know. And now you're about to take over as CEO of an organization which started with three people in one room, and now you have a staff of 500. How are you going into that? What happened starting January 1st? And you're following, you know, Joanne Page, 35 years, yeah. Has created, and yeah. You ended up being her partner for the last decade or so. Between you, you have created an extraordinary experience in the history of criminal justice, a program of formerly incarcerated people who probably have a strong effect on reducing crime as anything in our city. And now you're the head of it. What happens to you?
Yeah, I am so humbled and overwhelmed by the outpouring of support from the community of providers and advocates and from Fortune. I mean, there's a level of excitement in the agency, and I'm really excited about it. And so my goal is really to build on excellence. What Joanne has been able to do over the 34 years is amazing, and I've been fortunate to be part of that. But I'm going to continue to build on that excellence. I'm going to be focusing on people-first leadership, making sure that our staff have the tools and have the voice and partnership to help us strengthen what we're doing. We're going to continue to identify needs of our participants and be able to respond to those needs through services and replication of our services. We're going to continue to advocate and elevate the voices of those impacted by the legal system to try to change the policies that prevent people, once they come home, from truly, truly integrating into their community. And we're going to invite stakeholders from around the country to come join, to come first see what we're doing, then to come join us and support our work. But the focus is going to be, and this is something you and I spoke about the other day, the focus is going to be about strengthening what we currently have. And I am going to be a CEO that engages. I'm going to be a CEO that leads by listening. I'm going to be a CEO engages stakeholders and inviting them to come in and to be part.
And Stanley, before we get to all of that, you were in the news last week with an extraordinary meeting that you had with District Attorney Alvin Bragg. Now, I sat with you and Bragg, the DA, about a year ago. I think Rob DeLeon was in it and about three members of his staff. And you and Mr. Bragg talked about what could be. And I saw a respect, a mutual respect going back and forth, which is, I talk about unlikely things. A district attorney, a prosecutor, and a formerly incarcerated man talking about an arena in which they could share perspective. And a year later, maybe you can describe what he suggested. I think this, it was, I in the meeting where the seed was planted, and what blossomed from that?
Yeah, I think what he experienced when he came to the Thursday community meeting was a room that was filled with hope, even though people were struggling. And what he was able to take away, I think, was that a sense of how fortune goes about doing our work. And we go about doing our work by creating community and partnership. And that community gives hope. And so what D.A. Bragg has been doing since he got in office, he has been talking about public safety is more than arrest and prosecution. That a DA's role and the criminal legal system has to think about ways in which it could use its points of influence to change someone's life and to change their trajectory. And that means thinking outside the box, going beyond the punishment aspect of the system and going to the diversion and going to the post-release and going to use the sort of tools of a DA's office to partner with organizations like Fortune Society and Cases and Osborne and CJI, all of those organizations, and engage them in ways that they become partners in the system to disrupt what we've seen over generations, mass incarceration. And so I am so thankful that we're partnering with him, and he's using his office in some very innovative ways. And
at point of arraignment, we're going to have people be there?
Oh, yeah. At the point of arraignment, we're going to have peers in the courtroom. We're going to be engaging family members who are waiting for their loved one, the case to be called. Because here's the reality. The families that are attached to people who are going through the system are struggling, too. They may need resources for food. They may need resources to help pay rent. They may need resources to get mental health and substance abuse services. So we're going to be in the courtroom with our peers, have ready access to services for those who are standing before the judge. And we're going to engage their family to see if their family needs anything. We're going to have welcome kits that will have clothes and food and metro cards so that people, if they need anything, they can get it right there. They need access to housing. We're going to get them access to housing. And so it's really a way of interrupting this mission cycle.
Stanley, when you say metro cards, I remember Casimir Ettore's story. He said he was homeless in the park, and somebody said, if you go to Fortune, you can get a metro card. And he said, good, I'll get a metro card, and I'll sell it and get drugs. And that's what he did. He went to Fortune, got the metro card, sold it for drugs. And then he was rearrested. He was on Rikers Island, and he said to himself, I can't do this anymore. What am I going to do? And he said to himself, I know. I'll go back to the place where they gave me a metro card. And when he came in, he said, I don't want a metro card this time. I want my life.
That's right.
And that's right. You know, it's one person's story, but that's how you build the army, is one at a time. Stanley, on Monday, are you still there? Because I keep cutting
in. I'm here.
I'm not sure about the world, the way the technology. On Monday night, Fortune has its annual gala. And Joanne's big secret, and I'm letting it loose, is she's plotting to have a scene there on the stage where you, the new CEO, she the CEO for the last 3.5 decades, and me, her predecessor, standing together. That 55 years, three people. It's rather amazing, I think, that a organization, a nonprofit, could exist for 55 years. People don't leave. We stick around because it's, you know, when you're in a healing environment, you get stronger. And Fortune has made me stronger. I see it's made you stronger. And certainly Joanne has muscle that she doesn't even know she has. And we're going to have a good time Monday night.
We're going to have a great time. And my lovely wife, Tatara, will be there. And my three children. My oldest son is not able to come, but my three children will be there. And I'm really excited about it.
And everybody who's listening, Stanley Richards will be taking over Fortune, and only magic is going to happen. Mr. Richards,
Can I just close with a modified poem? And you heard it the other day. That really,
I've been saying that one for years. You know.
Oh my! Well, I
have different wording than yours. You want to hear my wording?
Yeah, let me hear your wording.
I didn't know it was Edward Markham. You said it, but I remember it. He made a circle and closed us out. But love and I had the wit to win. We drew a larger circle and brought him in.
That's it. And I think of Fortune's work like that. Like society has drew a circle to shut disproportionately impacted black and brown people out through mass incarceration, a thing to flout. But love and Fortune had the wit to win.
All right, I'm going to have a closing statement.
A circle that took people in.
Stanley, I'm going to have a closing statement, and that is, we talked earlier about, you taught me, you said it was very tough for me to say, all the time at the Thursday meetings, we always said to people when they were complimented, how do you feel? Because we deal with a population that is not used to and hasn't experienced praise. And you turned it on me and said, you can't take it either. And you often said, I love you. And I said, yeah. And you and Joanne, between you, talked to me about how to say love. And you said, until you get used to it, rub your nose. And I know that feeling. And one night, Big Rob, who had been at the castle, big guy, had done a lot of time. He had came to the castle. He moved out. He was doing well. And like many alumni, he came back for a Thursday night meeting. And I said to Rob, I'm taking the subway. And he said, I'll ride home with you. I'm going to Rockaway and I'll ride down with you. And as you and I were leaving, you rubbed your nose and I rubbed it back. And Rob said to me as we were walking up the street, what's that all that nose rubbing? And I said, Stanley was teaching me how to say I love you. that it's okay for people who really have deep feelings to each other to say it. It's not unmanly and it's not awkward.
We can
express all the other emotions except that tenderness. And so he listened, and we got on the subway train. And as I got off on 14th Street saying goodbye, he yelled, "Hey, Dave." And I, "What, Rob?" And he rubbed his nose.
Yes.
And I thought, that's it. That's what fortune is about. The rubbing of the nose of two men on a subway station on 14th Street. Stanley, I'll see you on Monday.
I'll see you on Monday, David.
Thank you for your
time.
And for the interruption as well. Let's hear from Michael Bublé, okay? Is that what's next? I know what's next. Is it Michael Bublé or is it Ray Bolger, Mr. Jacobs? Whatever you hit is fine with me. Ray Bolger.
I caught you, sir, having a look at her as she went strolling by. Now didn't your heart go boom, 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 boom? Now didn't you sigh? I warn you, sir, never to dream of her. Just bid such thoughts be gone, or it'll be boom, 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 boom. From then on, for once in love with Amy, always in love with Amy, ever and ever fascinated by her, set your heart afire to stay. Once you're kissed by Amy, tear up your list, it's Amy. Ply her with bonbons, poetry and flowers, moon a million hours away. You might be quite the fickle-hearted rover, so carefree and bold, who loves a girl and later thinks it over, then just quits cold. All at once in love with Amy, always in love with Amy, ever and ever sweetly you'll romance her. Trouble is, the answer will be that Amy'd rather stay in love with me. Ever and ever fascinated by her. Oh, I'm so happy. I want everybody to sing with me the next line. Once you're kissed by Amy.
Once you're kissed by Amy.
Tear up your list, it's Amy.
Tear up your list, it's Amy.
Ply her with bonbons, poetry and flowers.
Ply her with bonbons, poetry and flowers.
Moon a million hours away.
Moon a million hours away.
Let me take it. You might be quite the fickle-hearted rover, so carefree and bold, who loves the girl and later thinks it over, then just quits cold. Everybody sing Once in Love with Amy.
Once in love with Amy.
Always in love with Amy.
Always.
Ever sweetly
you romancer.
Ever and ever, sweetly you romancer.
Trouble is the answer will be
hot. Trouble is the answer will be.
Ha 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 ha. That ain't it rather still along with me.
Ray Bolger from Where's Charlie? Frank Lesser wrote that. There's a new television reality show coming in. It's called Flipper. It's not about a dolphin. It's about all the people that have flipped. Sidney Powell, Kenneth Cheeseborough, Jennifer Ellis, and sort of Mark Meadow. I'm not quite sure what he's doing, but they. I'm just wondering, all those guys that participated in January 6th, 1,000 of whom have been prosecuted, many of whom are in prison. I wonder what they're thinking, that what they're thinking is that all of these people close to Trump are now saying he lied, they knew it, and they went along with it. And how come all those people are getting probation and Trump is running for president and schmucky me is lying in a prison cell? What was the juice that they did in that town when they took all the juice, they bought into it and they're doing the time, and it's all a lie, and it keeps coming out as a lie. And Trump is fined $5,000 and then $10,000 for what? If anybody else threatened the lives or the safety or the danger of other people in court, they would be pulled in so fast. I wonder what would happen. Would there be street protests if Trump was pulled in? Interesting. I wonder what it will take for the Trumpies to, well, there you go, David. Mike Johnson is a Speaker of the House, and he's a believer. So you don't know. I want to remind everyone what I've said several times this morning. If you got an email sent from me with my name misspelled asking for money through Amazon or apparently to buy Christmas cards for my niece or something, it's a sham. It's a scam. My email has been broken into. You no longer can correspond with me through dprfortune@hotmail.com. I got virtually no emails today on theater tickets. If you want to go to any of the shows that we talked about today, you email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. We'll use that just for today. I'll get a new password for my other email address, my BAI email address. It's modern technology. We have tickets for a new show. It's called, it's coming to the York Theater. Now, those of us who have been to the York for the Muftis to see The Lieutenant or Golden Rainbow, struck by the extraordinary voices, the talent that they draw, it's been a miracle for me. When I saw The Lieutenant, I said, it should go right into the New York City Opera. It was that good. Anyway, the York Theater is doing a full production of a new musical called The Jerusalem Syndrome, and timing is everything, is it not? The Jerusalem Syndrome is an original musical comedy that explores psychological things that happen to people that visit Israel, and they recreate some of the religious. Well, it was they come to believe that they are characters from the Bible. They recreate, the contemporary people recreate the characters from the Bible. I don't know how it's going to play. It sounds fascinating. A musical that takes place in Israel now has to be provocative unto itself. But the York Theatre Company always has these extraordinary singers. And so I think a musical that's coming there is something to consider. We start with performances on Thanksgiving week, that whole week, Tuesday through Sunday. Of course, they don't play on Thanksgiving. It's $50 for a pair of tickets. If you want to plan ahead for Thanksgiving week, email me at drothenberg@fortunesociety.org. Give your phone number and I'll call you back. I also, the the November 12th Bacchanal with Malachi McCord and Moi has been long been sold out. And we're going to need a couple of volunteers to sit at the desk to check people in. Anybody interested in volunteering? We need just two or three people. And if you email me, I'll get and give you a phone number, I'll call you and interview you to see if you want to just sit at a desk and check people off. I wanted to cover so much today, but the email confused. You know what I wanted? One thing I wanted to talk about is stores in New York have a, you know, we all have a the history of different stores, and there have been some that have been bargains. I always remember women talking about going to Lowman's in the Bronx. And then there's something behind Macy's. I call it the dustpan. It's just, I don't even know if it's still there. It's on 35th and 6th, right off Herald Square. And it's filthy. But everything was $1.95. And therefore, you'd go in and you'd buy a rug. You'd have to, shake it out first. But my favorite was Klein's on Union Square. And bargains galore. And my favorite story, and it happened to my mother, and it's been attributed to a lot of other people, but it really did happen to my mother. There was a big box there with the boys' initial T-shirts. And my mother was going through, and this woman said, "What's the matter, darling?" And my mother said, "Well, I can't seem to find a D for my David in here." And the woman said, "For 98 cents, you'll give him a nickname for the summer." And that was Klein's. And I think we all have stories about stores that we treasured. That's part of the New York tapestry, part of the legend, the places we went to. And suddenly they're not there anymore, but we have the memories of it. What stores do you remember? You know, Rikers, remember? And they sponsored all the Nick games. Swish, good, like Nedix. Nedix were everywhere. They were the Dwayne Reed of its time. You went there for orange juice. Chock full of nuts. Are there any of those left? They were things that were just part of the city that we treasured. Stores, Carnegie Deli, gone. What do you have that you remember? All right. Do we have time for some music? Yeah. How about Michael Bublé in Home? We'll play that, and that might be it. And we're not making much money today for theater tickets because the computers have messed us up. But here's Michael Bublé, and we'll worry about everything next week.
Another summer day has come and gone away from Paris and Rome, but I want to go home. Maybe surrounded by a million people, I still feel all alone. Just wanna go home. Oh, I miss you, you know. And I've been keeping all the letters that I wrote to you, each one in line or two. I'm fine, baby, how are you? I would send them, but I know that it's just not enough. My words were cold and flat, and you deserve more than that. Another aeroplane, another sunny place. I'm lucky, I know, but I wanna go home. I got to go home. Let me go home. I'm just too far from where you are. I wanna come home. Someone else's life, as like I just stepped outside when everything was going right. And I know just why you could not come along with me. This was not your dream, but you always believed in me. Another winter day has come and gone away in either Paris or Rome, and I wanna go home. Let me go home. And I'm surrounded by a million people.
Michael Bublé, I'm David Rothenberg, and I'm a victim of technological intervention.
Get ready for the African Diaspora International Film Festival 2023, November 24 to December 10. Experience award-winning films, lively Q&As, and catered receptions. Come discover MK, Mandela's Secret Army, and historical drama Hope of Escape. For more information, visit NYADIFF or call 212-864-1760. ADIFF, where Black life matters. November 24 to December 10. Don't miss it.
Okay. Now you got a pitch.
Ask for money for WBAI?
Damn straight. You got to ask for money for WBAI, and you got to get people to give it, because you are now in charge of publicity and promotion. And if you don't get people to donate, we got to fire you.
So I have to tell everyone that WBAI listener-supported free speech radio, truth and justice radio, radio for the 99.5% on 99.5 FM is the best radio station in New York City. The only truly listener-supported station in New York City, and they should contribute to WBAI, become WBAI buddy members. And if they don't?
Then we gotta fire you.
You can't fire me.
Why?
Because I'm just a volunteer. WBAI doesn't have enough money to hire somebody to do publicity and promotion.
So what do we do instead?
How about a silly conversation like this that we can broadcast on the air and say, please support Peace and Justice, Free Speech Radio, radio for the 99.5% at 99.5 FM. Contribute. Become a WBAI buddy member.
All right, let it go.
Look out for the 2023 Brooklyn Folk Festival coming your way November 10th through 12th at St. Anne's Church in Brooklyn Heights. BrooklynFolkFest.com for full schedule and tickets. This year, we've partnered with Folkways Records to celebrate their 75th anniversary. The festival will feature numerous Folkways artists, including Ramblin' Jack Elliott, Peggy Seeger, The Fugs, Alice Gerard, Jake Blunt, Dom Flemons, Charlie Parr, and more. There's over 40 bands, plus workshops, jam sessions, film screenings, and the world-famous Banjo Toss Banjo Throwing Competition. Visit BrooklynFolkFest.com for full schedule and tickets, and see you November 10th through 12th at the Brooklyn Folk Festival.
Help WBAI rebuild. Our steady stream of BAI Buddy monthly subscriptions had built terrific momentum at its launch, and we need to rebuild that interrupted momentum again. Fill out the secure online form on our website at WBAI.org to donate $10 or more each month directly from your checking account or credit card, and you will get a WBAI tote bag, the member perks card for discounts around the city. You'll be able to donate in the name of OutFM. You'll be able to cut down on-air fund drive days, and this will support WBAI for as little as $10 a month. That's 33 cents a day.
On November 5th, 2023, from 5 to 8 p.m., Crossways Theater presents a fall festival of plays by award-winning writers on multicultural, multiracial